Welcome, everyone, and good afternoon to the Surgery Endorsement Maintenance Steering Committee conference call. And today the committee will be discussing phase two measures as well as discussing related and competing measures regarding AAA measures and viewing the harmonization plans for some of the prophylactic antibiotic measures. And finally, reviewing a newly submitted measure from ACS Measure 1741, Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems Surgical Care Survey. At this time, I'd now like to turn our conference call over to Dr. Morris, our co-chair.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for making it to the conference call today. I think our agenda is pretty well lined up as an overview. We have previously discussed measures 357, 359, 365, and 366, and we have a few more things to wrap up on those measures. We have also previously discussed the AAA measures 357, 359, 736, 1523, and 1534. And a few more things to talk about with regard to those. Also on our agenda, we will talk about the harmonization of prophylactic antibiotic measures. And for the first time, we will begin talking about the SCAPS measure and then have time for member and public comment. And then we'll talk about the next steps with Alexis. Any questions about that? Okay. So for starters, on the continuation of the phase two measures and the follow-up, we were going to discuss these measures in phase two, and specifically, Alexis, correct me if I'm wrong, but we have some questions for ARC, don't we, as a group?
Yes, we began looking at these measures on the last call on November 7th,
right,
looking at measures 357 and 359, and ARC noted that they did combine the mortality rate measure and the volume measure together in 359, but still wanted to maintain the volume measure, which is 357, as a standalone measure. And I know that some of the committee members had questions about that, and we do have Patrick Romano representing these ARC measures on the call, and he can give a brief overview of that information and answer any questions from the committee. And staff did review the measure evaluation form and noted that the combination of the two measures, mortality rate and volume, were only listed in the calculation algorithm section of the measure submission form on page 9, and so we did have some questions regarding that as well.
Okay, so specifically, Dr. Romano, what we'd like to know is what's the rationale for keeping volume as a standalone measure in addition to the fact that mortality and volume are a combined measure? And secondly, and I imagine that will be the most important part of what we need to know, but also want to just stipulate that the combined measure needs to be specified in the description and specification as well as in the algorithm.
Okay. Well, I'm here, and Jeff Geppert is also here representing the AHRQ team, so he'll fill in where I leave off. But I can say that the rationale for having the separate volume measure is that they really serve different purposes. So the mortality measure is a composite measure now of the stratified risk-adjusted mortality, where we're now stratifying by open versus ruptured aneurysms and endovascular versus open procedures. That is a risk-adjusted mortality measure in which hospitals, it's based on a hierarchical regression model in which hospitals are regressed or smoothed or shrunk, if you will, back to their volume stratified mean. So volume is incorporated only as a prior, if you will, for the best estimate of performance for small hospitals. Absent any reliable information about what the true mortality performance of small hospitals is, we fall back on the mean for all small hospitals of that volume size. So the volume is really just in the mortality measure as a basis for the prior distribution of hospital performance. On the other hand, many users are interested in knowing what the volume of hospitals is because there's interest in directing patients to higher volume hospitals, selectively contracting with higher volume hospitals, or having relationships in local communities that reward higher volume hospitals for maintaining their volume and for having the greater experience that they do. So the volume measure really has a separate and distinct purpose from the risk-adjusted mortality measure, even though the risk-adjusted mortality measure now incorporates volume-specific mortality as part of the calculation algorithm.
Okay, and I guess that I would paraphrase this to an extent by saying that the data seem to indicate that volume is a better predictor of mortality than mortality is, so incorporating volume into the mortality measure makes a lot of sense. If we measured only, if
but
we could
that,
only
that's
measure,
actually that's actually not true for endovascular to a certain extent because above 10 in the literature, you have equal results.
Is that Carol?
No, this is Dr. Halpern. This is Vivian Halpern. So.
Oh, hi, Vivian.
Yes. So above 10 has equal in the most recent literature for endovascular volume doesn't make a difference.
Okay.
It
so
does
do
make
you
a difference for open repairs. But not so much for endovascular.
Okay. And does that give you does that give you pause for incorporating volume into the mortality measure for this?
Well, I'm still trying to figure out about. I have to say, statistics is not my strong point, so I'll admit that up front. But to explain the shrinkage again, how that works with the shrinkage, and using a volume averaged for all small hospitals, and then how would that work on the provider level, which may be even smaller.
I don't think we're going to measure the provider level. Is that correct? I thought this was only at the hospital level.
That's correct.
Okay. Dr. Romano, can you clarify the shrinkage process?
Well, maybe I'll defer to Jeff Gepper for a few minutes.
Sure. So the shrunken rate, or what we call the smooth rate, is actually just a weighted average of two numbers. It's a weighted average of the hospital's risk-adjusted mortality rate and the volume-specific mortality rate. So it's a weighted average of those two things. And the weight is a reliability weight, basically a signal-to-noise ratio. So for smaller hospitals, that ratio tends towards zero, and for larger hospitals, it tends towards one. So for larger hospitals, there's more weight given to the hospital's risk-adjusted mortality rate, and for smaller hospitals, there's relatively more weight given to the volume-specific mortality rate.
So, Vivian, from year to year, I think that just looking at the mortality in a small hospital is not fair in some ways from year to year because you know, if they do one operation the year before, it's either going to be 100% or 0%.
No, exactly. That's why I have a concern about volume. So.
Right, but if they incorporate volume, then that will make it more truly reflective of the actual mortality. If they incorporate volume into the mortality measure, it is sort of fairer to that. It doesn't unfairly exaggerate the predictable mortality. Or underplay it.
And just to clarify one point, so because we estimate these volume-specific mortalities empirically using the empirical data, it doesn't really matter whether there's a huge difference between low-volume and high-volume hospitals or a small difference in mortality. Whatever that difference is, hospitals will be shrunk toward their own volume-specific mortality rate. So for obviously the extent of that movement is going to be greater for the open procedures because there's more disparity in the volume-specific rates, the volume-specific mean rates. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Are you satisfied with that explanation?
Yeah, I just, I don't know, as a person who likes to see things in front of them, the whole concept of sort of using empirical data is concerning, but I guess that's how it has to be done because you're doing it off of indirect data as opposed to, say, like a registry.
Okay.
The same method would be applied to registry data. And for example, the STF has used similar methods with its registry.
Okay. And then, Dr. Romano, can you talk a little bit more about the rationale for continuing to measure volume? I think that you know, it may be very straightforward to some and not as straightforward to others. So continuing to measure volume is a separate measure.
Well, it's just that volume has a different policy implications. And so for some users, for example, for managed care plans or health insurance companies or Medi-Cal plans, Medicaid plans that are interested in developing contractual relationships with hospitals, they would be interested to know what's the volume of the hospitals that are in their market. Similarly, for entities that are interested in looking at referral patterns in communities or encouraging referrals, it may be useful to look at volume separately. Many have advocated, specific volume thresholds, especially for open procedures. And so having a separate volume indicator allows people to apply a threshold that's evidence-based from the prior literature.
Vivian or anybody else, any questions about that?
So essentially, you're being the repository of the volume count? Is that what this measure becomes? Because I don't know that it should be a quality measure, although I do think that people should have access to that data, but I was wondering if there's other ways to have access to that data.
Is that a question for Dr. Romano?
It sounds like I'm just trying to understand it in my own head why it's important. It sounds like it's important for essentially people to be able to just look at the volume number.
Well, and it also provides context for interpreting the risk-adjusted mortality numbers, because if the volume is very small, then that risk-adjusted mortality estimate is basically just the average mortality for hospitals of that size. And so there's really very little additional information about the hospital's own performance that's going into that risk-adjusted mortality estimate. On the other hand, if the volume is high, then that risk-adjusted mortality estimate is more heavily weighted by the hospital's own experience. So in general, in a number of previous cases, NQF has supported the idea of pairing these measures so that users can have some context for interpreting the one knowing the other.
I would have to say that, I mean, that may work for healthcare companies and insurance companies, but do we really think that the average patient would understand that? I don't think so.
Let me just say that, I think that we understand that volume is a proxy for something that we can't fully define. And it's often used as a measure of quality, even though volume itself is not quality. It's whatever happens in the high volume hospitals that are doing rare operations. And we still haven't gotten down to that granular detail. But in terms of what a patient walking into the clinic might understand, I think people in general have common sense, and a really common question that I'm sure all of us clinicians have faced is, how many of these have you done? because people do have a sense that the more you do, the better you should be at it. And I think in that way, in terms of public reporting, in that way, that it may make sense to healthcare consumers. But you're right that probably the majority of the utility would be for probably for other stakeholders besides the consumers.
But I think that's one of the things that's important about the NQF measures is that they are used by a variety of parties for a variety of purposes. And there's not, you know, every measure doesn't have to meet every purpose and every audience.
Right. Anybody else from the committee that would like to comment on these measures or the explanation given by ARC?
This is Peter. I'm just picking up half the conversation, so I'll stay quiet. But the statistical analysis that we've engaged in that I did catch the tail end of sounded appropriate to me. So I'm comfortable with them to the extent that I've been listening.
Okay.
So, Arden, this is Terry in Seattle.
Yeah.
I've heard most of the conversation also, and I hate to ask such a pissant question, but who actually pays any attention to this? These numbers?
To hospital volume?
Or to,
yeah.
To say the risk-adjusted mortality? Who looks at these? Is that what you're asking?
Right. From a practical standpoint, do prospective patients look at them? Do doctors look at them? Or is this will it be looked at as part of a process, perhaps to adjust payment based on mortalities? Or shouldn't be... Shouldn't I be concerned about any of that?
I think that that's a really good question. I could envision at some point, as a sort of the quality improvement movement gains ground, that there will be some regionalization of care. Carol might even be able to say a little bit more about that from within the the payer community. I imagine that at some point that CMS probably will get more involved with saying who can do what, although we're nowhere near that right now.
Although I have to say there was actually a whole thing, it was on like a 60 Minutes or a 20, one of those kind of programs about how when patients don't want regionalized care because they don't want to have big operations far away from family support.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right.
Those are some more policy-level decisions that would be made at different levels than our committee. And what
yes.
Our job is just basically to figure out, do these measures fit the criteria that we have outlined and make a recommendation or endorsement based on whether or not they fit these criteria.
Right.
And in the future, I'm sure that more will be done with them. You know, we may see a butterfly effect. We may see that things linger without having any effect for a long period of time. It's a little bit hard to know.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
in terms of the uses, I think I can comment on that. You know, as a health plan, we do measure a variety of things for a variety of purposes, but we profile hospitals, we profile physician practices, we have pay-for-performance programs, we have ACO contracts, we have patient-centered medical home contracts. And to the extent that's possible in all of those scenarios, we try to use endorsed measures when we can. Sometimes there aren't standardized measures, and then we have to create our own or adapt something. But to the extent that we can use something that's standardized, it's much preferable. And we are constantly, you know, and there's, centers of excellence programs, you know, so that there's a variety of different programs where the data is used. And it's to everybody's advantage if there are standardized measures that we can use.
Great. Carol, thank you. That was a great answer. I appreciate it. I guess where I was coming from, and I won't divert the conversation any longer, is that at some point, the kind of information we collect with respect to the services that have already been performed has to move kind of backwards in time and be utilized in a fashion that helps at the moment of care or in the decisions
right.
made with respect to even offering that kind of care. And so that's my hope, is that in addition to sort of the post-service analysis and payment and chastisement, if that's to come, it would be useful, I think, if we were to gather all this information and provide it in such a fashion that it could be enveloped into the decision-making process that happens on a patient-to-patient basis. So that's my fond hope, and with that, I'll be quiet.
All right. Is there anybody else on the steering committee that would like to talk about this or make comments or ask questions? I think that we need to decide then if these measures are essentially to be recommended. Is that right, Alexis, or do we need to move on to the pancreas measures first?
We can get an overall consensus, but the committee will vote via SurveyMonkey as well after the call.
On 357, 359?
Yes, but if you'd like to get in consensus from the group now, that's fine.
I think we can just move on then if we're going to be doing the exact same thing but through SurveyMonkey after.
Okay.
So the next two are the pancreas measures. And we need to look at the testing that was performed by AHRQ and to give AHRQ a chance to introduce the changes that you have made. So will that be Patrick Romano again?
I think Jeff will take the lead here.
Okay.
So the primary change that was implemented at the request of the steering committee last summer was to include benign cancers in the denominator and to harmonize the specifications for the volume and the mortality measure. And the request was to present some data that was stratified by both pancreatic cancer cases and non-pancreatic cancer cases. So those are the results that were included in the revised submission form.
Okay. And let's see, are we going to go through the – are there questions listed at the top of the measure here that we're going toward?
This is Rick. Yeah, I specifically reviewed these, and I'm happy with the data provided and how they have done the stratification.
Okay. Any other issues? Rick, anything else that you would like to say about this? Any points of conflict that we should discuss?
No, I think I'm happy with the measure. I mean, our biggest objection before was that one of them included all pancreatic surgeries and the other one was just malignant disease.
Cancer.
That seemed irrational.
Okay.
Fixed it and the data looks fine.
Okay. And then, let's see, Alexis, what are we to do now with these measures? Are we to make a decision about them, or are we going to be voting on them later?
Yes, you'll be voting on all the measures discussed on today's call via SurveyMonkey.
Okay, that sounds fine. Okay, and now next, a discussion of harmonizing prophylactic antibiotic measures.
Next, we're going to review the AAA repeated competing and related measures.
Okay.
And so in your package, you were given a related and competing measures table of the AAA repair measures. And at the very top of that table, we outlined some of the information and listed some things that were different about each of the measures that are under consideration for related and competing, as well as anything that was similar.
I'm really having a hard time seeing the font on this screen.
Would it help if we, society, if we perhaps walk through tie level each of the measures?
That would help me.
Hard for you to read. Okay. Alexis, do you want to go ahead and do that, or?
Sure, that's fine. So looking at the first two that we just reviewed, measure 357 and 359, and looking at the measure focus, there's a similar measure focus to the current endorsed measure 736, the leapfrog measure. However, 357 and 358, if you scroll down to page, sorry, I'm still scrolling. If you scroll down to page 28 and you look at the level of analysis, you can see that they're all at the facility level. And if you look at the data source of the first three, they all are using administrative claims. However, if you look at the SVS measures, the two newly submitted measures to the project, you'll see that they're using registry data in comparison to the ARC measures and the current endorsed measure that's using administrative claims. And you can also see, looking at the level of analysis for the SVS measures, that it's also at the facility level. However, it's also at the clinician level as well.
This is Patrick. Could I clarify something?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah, so just to be clear about the distinction between the leapfrog predictor, 0736, and the AAA repair mortality measure, 0359. So 0359 is based on patient-level or record-level discharge or administrative data, and it incorporates a risk adjustment using patient characteristics as specified on pages 8, 9, and 10 of this table. The leapfrog predictor is designed to be collected through a survey of hospitals, where they ask hospitals to do their own analysis and to report on their number of cases and their mortality rate using defined specifications. But there's no patient-level data that's collected by a central source, and therefore there's no risk adjustment model. So that's the fundamental difference between those approaches. One is designed for someone who has a collection of patient-level data. The other is designed for an organization that's simply surveying hospitals and asking them to report hospital-level summary of their experience.
I'm just reading Leapfrog's reason why they didn't do a risk adjustment, too, which was basically that they said that there was no difference between doing a risk adjustment and not.
Yeah, they don't have a lot of faith in risk adjustment as a group. So on the plus side for registry data, it seems like, you know, data that's collected primarily and not for administrative claims purposes would tend to be more accurate. But on the downside, there's no risk adjustment.
Well, they're not doing even registry data. They're just doing a hospital. It sounds like they're doing even less than that, a registry. They're just having the hospitals tell them what their survival rate is. They're also looking at survival rather than death.
Exactly. Leapfrog is simply surveying the hospitals, sending them a questionnaire, and then the hospitals submit the answers to the questionnaire, and they basically fill in the number of patients that had the surgery and the number that died.
Alexis, in this decision-making, are we supposed to choose a winner here? 736 is already endorsed, yeah?
Yes, it currently is. So first we need to decide if there are any harmonization issues or if these measures are competing. If they are competing, we need to select one or indicate why the competing measures should stand and why.
Why both should stand potentially?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
This is Heidi, if I could just add a couple more things. So 736 is endorsed. The endorsement, the question of whether it should remain endorsed or not is not before this committee.
Yeah.
The question is on the measures that you have before you. So, again, I think you do need to look at whether or not these are competing measures. I think that in many ways, I would say they are. They have been viewed that way in the past when they've been looked at. And we have gotten a clear direction from the CSAC and the board that in most cases, they would like us to determine whether one measure should go forward before another. And this is something that the board actually will be discussing even further at their meeting on Thursday. So the more that you can perhaps come to a decision, now it may be you could say that you believe the ARC measures are better meet the criteria, and that would be something that would then move forward when the leapfrog measures are reviewed and we would have two measures out there. You may actually also say that you feel that the leapfrog measure is fine and meets the criteria better than the ARC measure, similar with the SVS. And so those are kind of the things that we need you to think through and talk about and then come up with your final recommendation. Hope that's helpful.
That is helpful. Thank you. Anybody on the committee want to comment on that or have any thoughts about whether we consider these measures to be competing?
Well, I think they're definitely competing. They look at the basically the same thing stated in a different way. The leapfrog has not, ARC has separated out now, endovascular risk is open, and it looks like leapfrog completely eliminated ruptures as any part of it, because they specifically say it's for non-ruptured.
Right.
But they didn't separate endovascular versus open. So I do have a problem with that aspect of it, because that can make a great difference on how the outcomes of those patients.
Is there anybody on the committee that would favor 736 over the others, over 357, 359? Sounds quiet. What about in the other direction? I have to say that I favor 357, 359 over 736, and I do see them as competing as well. Anybody have a different opinion about that?
This is Connie Steed. I concur with you.
Okay. All right. So although we're not really, it's not our charge to say too much about 736 at this time, I think that our recommendations will hopefully be brought forward in the future when it's reviewed. And if the board is, if this is the sort of thing that the board is looking for from us, it sounds like basically as a group we're either non-committal or on the side of the fact that these are competing and that 357, 359 are stronger than the leapfrog measure.
I agree with that, Ms. Terry.
Okay.
And one thing, though, Alexis will specifically in the Survey Monkey ask you to provide a rationale so that we mm-hmm. can really write this up so it's very clear to the membership and everyone else. And then moving forward, as the leapfrog measure would be up for review in the future, we'll carry that forward as well.
Okay. And so I would say as the rationale, and I'd invite anybody in the steering committee to either add to this or if you have a disagreement to bring it right up, but I'd say in what we've talked about so far, as Vivian said, the ARC measure distinguishes between endovascular and open, that the ARC measures risk adjust, and that they have the additional advantage of incorporating volume. I believe that the leapfrog measure also incorporates
volume. It does incorporate volume.
Yeah, but does not risk adjust and also is hospital reported based on hospital survey. And other way, although it, if it's labeled as registry-derived might seem to carry more weight doesn't necessarily provide any additional information over the claims-based method. Anybody disagree?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Any other advantages to the ARC measure over the leapfrog measure? Vivian, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
Now, in terms of the SVS measures, I think they're different in because they're specifically looking at smaller aneurysms and open versus endovascular as two separate measures. And again, the issue is that there's a lot of, if you look at the aneurysms being done out there, a lot of them are done for sizes less than is this threshold for fixing aneurysms under the current guidelines.
A lot of them are done for aneurysms that are size less than what?
Than the recommended. They're done for relatively small aneurysms.
Okay.
There's a lot done in the community that are done for smaller aneurysms than the recommended size of threshold. And so the SVS concern was that if you're doing these, you better have really good outcomes because you're already, you know, it'll be the reasons that they're done at a smaller size are a variety of reasons. One might be that it's growing faster than the expected rate. One might be the appearance of it. And, you know, there's usually some kind of documentation as to why the smaller aneurysms are being done. But the SVS has a concern that if you're going to do smaller aneurysms where the indications are already a little shakier than for doing large aneurysms where the risk of rupture is much more real, that you better have good outcomes. And that's why they chose to do these separately as a marker, you know, for quality.
Okay, so you're seeing this primarily as a separate measure and not a competing measure because they're talking about small aneurysms?
Yes, because none of the other ones sort those out,
mm-hmm.
and they particularly address size.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going to do it for a smaller aneurysm, you're really, not that you shouldn't have good outcomes for any size, but, you know, if you're doing a 7-centimeter aneurysm, you know, the patient has about a 30% risk of rupturing. So, as opposed to somebody with a 5.5 or less centimeter aneurysm, if it's less than 5.5 at that size, they have a 5 to 7% chance of rupturing. So your outcome has to be, your risk of surgery has to be less than that.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they did it was actually kind of clever because, you know, they want people to make sure that they're looking at the rest of the patient, basically. So if you're going to do a 5-centimeter aneurysm, it shouldn't be in a guy who's, you know, like 70 with home oxygen and an EF of 25% because the chances of them doing well or living long is not good, even sometimes with an endovascular.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if you're gonna do it, you better be doing it for the right reasons and have a good outcome. So I see them as different.
Okay. Do you see any downsides to measure 1523 or 1534?
Well, the issue again always comes up with the registry issue because you do need some kind of a registry. It doesn't have to be the SVS registry, but you do need some kind of registry where the size will be documented. Now, everybody should be documenting the size of the aneurysm in the chart before they fix it because that is the main indication of size. So it shouldn't be a hard piece of data to extract. But
so when you say that the issue arises again as a registry, meaning that the hospital.
Well, because we keep having this discussion of registries, and is one registry better than another?
Volunteer registry, right?
Yeah. Now, the SVS has, I think, gotten through. I don't know if there's anybody on the SVS from the call, so maybe they can answer this, but I think they were trying to put through a code to indicate size. And I think that it got accepted. It was the last thing that I heard.
You mean a CMS code?
Yeah. So that would make it easier to pick up from a claims data point of view, too.
Is there anybody on the line from SVS?
Are you asking STS or SVS?
I thought this was SVS, Society of Vascular Surgeons, isn't it?
Yes.
It's not Society of Thoracic Surgeons, is it?
No, it's Society for Vascular Surgeons.
Yeah.
This is Heidi. I think Tim Creswick's on the webinar. I don't know if he's – is his line open? I know he's the one SVS representative we have on the – Tim around?
I am, but I'm not – my line must be muted somehow.
No, we can hear you now.
Okay, all right. So let me just explain this, the rationale of what we're trying to do here, and Vivian has done a nice job. But the thing that we're trying to counteract, which if you look from a health policy point of view, one of our biggest problems we're all facing is costs. And I would have to agree with what Vivian is saying, is that right now there's, especially in the endovascular arena, there's probably tremendous overuse of endovascular aneurysm repair for aneurysms on patients that would be best having nothing done. So our purpose here is to try to create a measure that, in a sense, is self-risk adjustment, so you don't need risk adjustment. And, in fact, by risk adjusting, you would be rewarding people for doing the wrong thing. So the principle here is that if you are doing someone that has a moderate or small aneurysm, you should factor into your decision-making their age, their expected longevity, their comorbidities, because you're doing a purely prophylactic procedure whose only benefit can be to perhaps prevent rupture. So if you're doing it on a small enough aneurysm that's unlikely to rupture, in the next 5 years on someone who has a life expectancy of 2 years, you've obviously not benefited anyone. So that's the basic principle. And I do want to comment related to the administrative versus registry data. The only reason this is coming before you as a registry is because that's the only avenue we had for bringing it forward. We do have now, and it's gone through the CPT-2 approval process, is to have administrative codes that people can size aneurysms and present this data. Now, the beauty of this approach, too, is that it becomes promoting in that if down the road, once these codes are available, if people don't report these codes, if you assume that they fall into the small or moderate category, you again have the ability to capture 100% of patients being done. So it will be eventually available through an administrative route, but because of the rules at NQF, we could only bring it forth in this manner. So my major question as you go forward in terms of talking about harmonization is, you know, at what point will these be rediscussed if they're going to be seen as competing, you know, how will that be resolved in the future? So I don't know how that will impact on this discussion now, but I do think in relationship to things like volume, which actually has a very perverse incentive to increase the overutilization that's happening out there now. So in fact, from a health policy point of view, it's probably destructive to have volume as an indicator of quality, because many of these institutions are, if anything, overutilizing as it is now.
Okay, so if we stick with the SVS submitted measures, which don't include volume and are really about small AAAs, I agree with Vivian that this is not a competing measure based on what you've said so far. Anybody disagree with that? Anybody think that this is a competing measure with the ARC measures? And then the second point about it being registry data, I think that's, you know, as was pointed out, that's basically what we have right now, although in the future we'll have something different. We'll be able to potentially use administrative data for these purposes when the CPT-2 codes are widely used. Alexis, would it be appropriate for us to say that in the future that we anticipate that this could potentially be harmonized with the other measures?
Sure. Heidi, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think, so just to add on to what Tim said, because they did not have the testing on the use of the CPT Category 2 codes because they didn't have the codes yet,
right.
That was one reason why we couldn't bring them forward. But I think when they do bring it forward, it will either result in, depending on the timing, an ad hoc review where we will look to see how the measure is fared using those codes. And then at the next review, again, where we would be looking at the ARC measures, potentially the LeapFrog measure, depending on the timing, as well as the SVS measures, assuming they all go forward. If they bring forward the claims data, then I think the expectation would be, number one, that they are harmonized to the extent they are. They do measure different things. I think we've talked that through, and it's very, at least clear to me, the differences. And then look to see that harmonization has occurred, because I think unless for some reason there's a different interpretation when there's the next review, that would be what we would be looking for, and that's the expectation that I think you all can put forward now. But if that does happen, you would want to see that.
Okay, I'm all for putting that expectation forward. Does anybody disagree? Anybody want to speak up, ask any questions, or raise any conflicts with this?
Sounds good.
All right. And Rick, anything else that you want to add in terms of like thinking about elderly people and their lifespan in terms in providing desk care? I remember you had some comments previously, some time ago.
No, I think these measures are okay, as we've discussed. I'm in agreement with what's been said.
Okay. All right. I think we can probably move on from that then. The next item on the agenda is...
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Let's see. I need to find my agenda here. With legible font. Is it time for us to move on to harmonization of prophylactic antibiotic measures?
Yes.
All right, great. We're right on time, which is nice. let's see. So we asked the developers to provide plans on harmonizing or combining multiple prophylactic antibiotic measures. And that won't be available for some time. We wanted for the developers to provide a plan to harmonize to the committee. And Alexis included their response in our document. They haven't had time to produce this plan. The NQF staff recommended that we can't wait for harmonization, so we could consider recommending both for endorsement. Or simply discuss a little further before we get to our recommendation.
Right, and this is Alexis. Just to add to that, so for this first group, we have two maintenance measures in the discontinued group, 529 and 128. And so the committee held off on voting on final recommendation for endorsement because they had these suggestions for harmonization regarding the exclusions and the end times. And we did take this back to the various measure developers, and they are currently working to schedule a conference call to begin discussions on how to harmonize. And unfortunately, it won't happen most likely within this project. So what staff is suggesting, which is similar to the next few measures in which you've already voted on, if you do like the measures as they stand currently, you can vote for the measures with the expectation that those measures will be harmonized and submitted to the next surgery project, which is scheduled to launch in 2013.
Do we have another option?
Yes, you can vote the measures down as they currently stand.
Yeah. Practical status is that they'll have to coexist, correct? At least
the downside to them coexisting?
Because they are, this is Dale Bratzer, one of the developers. I, you know, these measures, some are used in the hospital setting, and the others are the PCPI measures, which are collected through a very different mechanism.
So until they're harmonized, we shouldn't be voting them down. Shouldn't be closing them then, should we?
If we did vote them down, would that mean that they would not be harmonized in the future?
Well, it's not that easy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is Heidi. I mean, if you remove endorsement, there's no reason to not expect that they would continue working on harmonization, and I think they would have the opportunity to bring back the measures for consideration at the next opportunity with the expectation that the harmonization would be done by then. But you have to weigh the implications, and it truly is your call on whether having the measures there, while not perfect yet and harmonized yet, is a better value at the moment than having measures, the endorsement removed, and waiting until the next time we know for sure would be 2013, where they could bring the measures back in. And so it is your call as to how you would like to proceed on this.
Does anybody see a downside to endorsing the measures?
I don't.
How about you, Carol?
I agree.
Okay. Well, I think that we should proceed then. I think we should go ahead and recommend that we endorse and, go with the staff recommendation that that these could be submitted with the expectation that they would be harmonized in the future, although it's not that easy, as Dale said. Anybody disagree?
Nope.
Okay. So let's see here. I'm going to pull up my agenda again. Anything else that we need to discuss with regard to those measures, Alexis?
No. I just wanted to point out the second set selection of the antibiotic measures, and then that third set timing and receipt. The committee has already voted on the maintenance measures, and you did vote with the expectation that those measures will be combined with the currently endorsed measures and submitted under the next project in 2013. But you did ask for an harmonization plan, and so I just wanted to provide the measure developer response, and it's the same response from the first set. They're currently working together to figure out how to combine and harmonize the measures. But I just wanted to provide that information to you all, but there's nothing that the committee needs to vote on, no action taken.
Okay. Our next agenda item is a review of Measure 1741, the Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems, the CAHPS Surgical Care Survey. And I do not believe that this was assigned to any of the committee members to introduce. It replaced another measure. It was submitted by the American College of Surgeons. And we wanted to have a representative from the American College of Surgeons give the introduction for the measure. Is there somebody on the line right now that can do that?
Joanne from Westat should be giving a brief overview. Joanne, are you on the line?
She's on the website.
Hold on. Joanne, your line's open.
Okay. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you all for this time, and I'll just give a really brief overview, and then I guess we can go into questions and answers. But the CAHPS Surgical Survey is basically patient experience survey and set of measures that's designed to specifically assess patients' experiences with surgical care. And it's based from and informed by the existing CAHPS instruments, which assess patient experience in other settings of care, like hospitals and the outpatient ambulatory settings with the clinician and group survey, and the ACS basically funded the development of this survey in conjunction with the Surgical Quality Alliance, and its basic goal is to measure aspects of surgical quality that are important to consumers and for which consumers are actually the best source of information. So it measures things such as how well the surgeon communicates with patients before surgery, surgeon's attentiveness on the day of surgery, information that patients receive to help them recover from surgery. So what we are proposing is that the six composites that are included in the survey are up for endorsement, plus a single item global rating, which asks about the basically an overall rating of the doctor, of the surgeon. So that's pretty much the very quick overview. And if we want more of a background, then I can also go into the development process and sort of the fundamental information that's in the package.
Can you talk about how it was validated?
Sure. So, as I said, the surgical survey was informed by the existing CAP surveys, as well as a literature review that was conducted by the American Institutes for Research under contract with ACS. And so a literature review was done. There were two rounds of focus groups with consumers asking them questions about what they consider to be good quality surgical care. There was an item development process that was then proceeded through cognitive testing, where the survey items were completed by patients, and then patients responded about how well they understood the questions and whether they thought the questions were measuring important aspects of surgical care. And then a field test was employed with patients, and let me find information about that. The field test was done in the summer of 2008 and included patients from 96 surgeons and 33 practices across 9 surgical specialties. And so AIR received data from a total of 2,750 patients. And that data was then psychometrically analyzed to look at the factor structure of the items, to see how well they held together as concepts, to assess their reliability, and that information is included in the packet. After the psychometric, after the field test and the psychometric results, the CAPS consortium, and the CAPS consortium was involved in the process with ACS and AIR throughout. And when the consortium reviewed the results from the psychometric analysis, they asked for some additional testing on the labels that were used for the composites, and that work was done. And then some modification was done to the composites and the titles of the composites. So the ones that we are showing you here in the submission and providing for your consideration are the final composites. So there are, as I said, 6 composites and then 1 full rating, and the composites have anywhere from 2 to 4 items.
Okay, this is Alexis from NQF, and I just wanted to let the committee know that we did do a staff evaluation of the measure. And we have Karen Pace on the call as well. She's our in-house methodologist. And I'm not sure, Karen, if you wanted to make any statements before the committee began their evaluation.
Yeah, thanks. This is Karen Pace. I just wanted to clarify for everyone, because it's a source of confusion for all of the CAPs, is that NQF endorses performance measures that are based on using the CAPS survey as the data source. So it's a little bit of a fine distinction, but we're not simply endorsing the survey. We're endorsing if it's recommended and goes this way, NQF would be endorsing the performance measures that use the CAPS survey as the data source. And so I think it would be important to understand what are the performance measures, and perhaps we can just get some clarification. My understanding from reading this is that for each one of those measures, the composites or the global rating, that the developer is suggesting that the performance measure that, for example, would end up getting reported if this were picked up for public reporting would be the percentage of responses for each response category. Or my question is, because I know for some of the CAPS and public reporting, what's reported as the performance measure is just the top response category. So maybe the measure developer could walk through what are the measures and how are those are computed.
Certainly. There are different ways that you can report. So like you're saying, you could report, for example, in the first composite called Information to Help You Prepare for Surgery, there are two items, and the response options are yes, definitely, yes, somewhat, or no. So the questions are something before your surgery, did anyone in the surgeon's office give you easy-to-understand instructions about getting ready for your surgery? Yes, definitely, yes, somewhat, or no. You could report the percentages of patient response to each of those response options, or as you were saying, Karen, you can report the quote-unquote top box score or only the percentage who answered yes, definitely. Alternatively, you could report a mean score, but most people are not reporting mean scores because they have less sort of, it's harder to understand what a mean is between a 1, 2, and a 3. So what you see in the submission is that basically it's the percentage who are reporting the top box is what we're saying, that the probably the most often reported Carla Zima is also here, part of the team who is helping us prepare this submission, as well as Sophia Chakrakletis, who's here at WSFAT. So I'm going to extend the invitation to Carla and Sophia to jump in at any time if they want to elaborate on any of my answers.
Can I just clarify something with you? So suppose that 20% of the responses are yes, definitely, and a very small proportion, like 5%, is no, and everything else is yes, somewhat, for hospital A. And then for hospital B, they have 30% of their responses as yes, definitely, and they have 50% of their responses as no. Then they're going to come out looking better, right? Because they have more yes, definitely. Is that correct?
Yes, in a top box scoring approach.
Right.
Yes.
So, but if you took the mean, then they would definitively look worse, right?
Yes.
So, but your decision was to go with the top box scoring rather than the mean?
Yes. I mean, there are different purposes. You can calculate the scores in different ways, but for public reporting, and particularly given that CMS reports this way with hospital caps, it's most likely going to be the top box score. And
okay.
I have to say that you really almost never see huge percentages in the negative range on any of the CAPS surveys. I don't think I've ever seen that, where you'd have even as much as 50% in them. Okay. Carla, would you agree?
I do. And I think the other rationale for doing top box scoring is to set the bar for from an improvement perspective to say that the most important outcome is the top box?
Mm-hmm. Well, I like that rationale. I think that that's a good rationale. On the other hand, it'd be really nice to know how well the mean correlates with top box scoring in this particular, you know, in using the CAP surveys. Has anybody looked at how well it correlates?
Anecdotally, when we've had users, and this is not specific to this survey, for any CAP survey, you can use mean scoring, you can use top box scoring. The other advantage to top box scoring is it's easier to understand from a consumer perspective versus the mean scoring. Anecdotally, we know users that have looked at their data both ways just to kind of see what the difference would be, have not found that there are significant differences in how, in essence, the different units are compared when you do it one versus the other. I
so
will clarify.
Like really it sounds like we really don't know that nobody has really sort of compared these things and seen what the correlation is, so we're sort of going with a probably.
I did want to clarify that this is an ambulatory instrument mainly, primarily. It is sampled at the ambulatory level, at the surgeon level, or the surgical practice level. So you had said hospital A and hospital B. I just wanted to clarify that we are talking about a survey that is administered based on the ambulatory setting.
Okay, when you say ambulatory setting,
clinical?
Are the surgeries only ambulatory?
No. The surgery could be an inpatient, but it's based upon records that are based on a surgeon's ambulatory practice. So we're talking about surgeons at their practice level and not necessarily out of hospital data.
Okay, so at the clinic level, and who would be responsible for implementing this? Would the surgeons bear the burden of, or would the surgical clinics bear the burden of implementing and reporting?
I'm going to take a stab, and then I'll kind of turn it over to ACS as well for their response from an ACS and SQA perspective. From the CAPS perspective, we see a number of different scenarios, if you will, of implementation. There are implementations at the community level where you do have an external organization that sponsors the implementation of it. We also do see plenty of implementation of surveys like this that are implemented by the practices themselves for not only for internal quality improvement, but also now, for example, ABMS from the maintenance of certification requires some communication items that are based on the CAPS clinician group survey, and they have also agreed to accept the surgical care survey instead for specialties for which this survey is more relevant.
This is Bob Jasek from the American College of Surgeons, and I would just agree with all of that. And basically just to say that you could use it the same way as the clinician in group, and one of the reasons that we created this was because the questions just didn't fit right in that for surgeons. And so this is
This is Karen Pace again. Most of the information you provided is about the item-level analysis. And I think you said you had something like 96 surgeons or practices in your testing pool. Is that correct?
Yes.
Can you provide any of the surgeon-level performance data without identifiers, but to give the committee an idea of how these are scoring at the performance measure level?
One of the appendices, trying to find it here, attachment I has the surgeon level results from the surgical care field test.
Okay.
And that basically shows you let me find that appendix. It shows you the minimum score for a surgeon, the maximum score, which usually is 100%, and then it shows the confidence interval and the mean for the surgeons.
Oh, great. Do we have that?
It would be Appendix I.
And where is that in the document we have?
That's in your
appendix, so no, it's not in the
It's listed at the end of the main document of the application, and it was provided as a separate zip file.
Right. So, Alexis, right. maybe this you can.
Right. This is Alexis. This was sent out by Jessica when we sent the original measure submission form. There were a series number of attachments, so we did not submit it or we did not attach it in these materials because of the document size, but you all were sent it. I can forward to everyone very quickly again while we're on the call, but it was sent on October
26th. Yeah,
and I'll just forward it again.
Yeah, Jessica, can you project it, too? I don't know if you can. That might be helpful for those on the webinar.
Sure, I can project it.
Okay, right. We'll project it, too. Let me help.
So I have a question about the data. I'm on page 118 of the long document that we got, which is the scores for all measure components. And the scores are all really, really high. Are these top two box or are these top one box? What are these scores? That we have in the document.
Can you tell me the name of the document?
Well, the document is the one they
after what page?
The one they sent out for the meeting today that has
the submission form, you mean?
The submission form, and it's on page 14 and 15 and 16 of the submission form.
Oh, okay.
And so, like for question 3. The score was 97.6%. For question 4, it was 98.9. The scores are really high, and I'm just trying to understand. And those it says positive response. Is positive response top one box, top two box?
The top box, yes.
That's
no,
top.
But right, I think that's a good question, because and it's the same question about the Excel file, because it says percent yes. So that includes the yes definitely and the yes somewhat, or just the yes definitely?
That is yes. So the field test version of this instrument had yes, no items. And for that very reason, so this is a survey that was developed, sponsored by ACS, developed by AIR, American Institutes for Research, outside of the CAPS Consortium. It got submitted to the CAPS Consortium for review and adoption into the CAPS family of surveys. When the CAPS Consortium reviewed the survey, we agreed that there was not enough variation given a standard 2-point yes-no scale, and so we required that they adopt the 3-point yes-no scale, which shows more variation, so you will not see such severe ceiling effects.
But it has the final version has a 3-box rather than like a 5-box option?
Correct, and the reason that it does not have we don't use a standard, for example, 4-point frequency scale, is because the items are asking about specific things that happen or they don't. They tend to be one time. If you only had one preoperative visit, you can't ask about a frequency.
And actually, Carla, I think in the field test there were a couple of versions, again, because AIR conducted it, it's our understanding of the exact details, but there are some frequencies that do show yes, definitely, yes, somewhat, and no, somewhat, and definitely no. So there were some options that were tried in the field test with regard to the yes, no, yes, definitely, yes, somewhat, no, and then a 4-point version, actually.
So, right, but when they're reporting percentage yes, they are mapping the definitely yes and somewhat yes to their yes. So, in essence, it is, if it was a 3-point scale, they are reporting 2 levels of the scale.
Yeah, so if you read the note at the top of that document, says it's kind of interpreting the scale. So, yes is yes for a simple yes, no, or definitely yes, somewhat yes, for ones that use that option. So there were 2 options that were used, a straight yes, no, and a definitely yes, somewhat yes. And this is combining either just a yes or a definitely yes, somewhat yes, but that was out of a 4-point yes, no scale.
So, and just to clarify then, you don't have actual performance results on the final scale that you've submitted for
NQF endorsement. Is that correct? Or?
Well, the percentages are reporting where we have, where they used a yes, now it's reporting the yes, where they used a definitely yes, somewhat yes, a definitely no, a somewhat no, definitely no, it's reporting the top two, definitely yes and somewhat yes. So it's not exactly the same response option that's shown, but as you can see, it is true that they are very, as we would say, negatively skewed or very positive overall. And that's not unusual for CAPS items either.
Okay, so in terms of the issues with this measure so far, and this is Arden, and I have to say that I think it looks like a very well thought out survey. We really were very strongly in favor of measures around patient-centeredness in our in-person meeting, and this would absolutely fit that. There are still some issues that are outstanding or unclear to me. One is that we don't know what the final scale responses look like. We don't have that information. A second outstanding issue is that we really don't know what the correlation is between the mean score and the top box score, and it would be nice to know that, to have some kind of reassurance that using the top box score is the right approach to this. And then thirdly, it's still not really clear to me who bears the cost of conducting the survey and reporting the results. It's not clear to me whether that would be a cost that would fall upon individual clinics or if it would fall on some external body or exactly where it would fall. So those things remain unclear. Are there other issues that are unclear for the steering committee members? Anybody on the steering committee that would like to bring up any other issues?
I'd respond to one thing about cost and, and who does the survey. With the other CAPS surveys, with the health plan survey, with the HCAPS, with the clinician and group survey, the surveys are in the public domain, and anybody who wants to do it can do it. And anybody who wants to do the survey bears the cost. And so I think that, the answer in terms of cost is probably it depends on who wants the results and why they want them. Because it could be, it could be done by a health plan, it could be done by a hospital, it could be done by physicians themselves. I think it would depend upon, the particular setting. I don't think the fact that there's a survey doesn't mean that there's just one way of paying for it.
Okay, so this would potentially not really have anything to do with CMS and would not necessarily be required for providers to submit these data.
Right, and if CMS did require it, then for that purpose, they might mandate that the physicians pay for it, for example. But the survey itself, a CAPS survey is typically in the public domain, and so if we as a health plan want to use it, we can do it, we can pay for it, we can look at the results, and, or CMS might at some point mandate it. That would be up to CMS, but it would, I think there's the survey itself is independent of the payment mechanism.
One of the things that we have looked at as we're reviewing these quality measures is what the burden is on, for most of them on hospitals, which wouldn't apply to this particular situation. But that has been part of our discussion. Does it not belong in our discussion with this current measure?
Yeah, because if it's just to do surveys, then why does it need to be endorsed?
Well, we as a health plan wanted data on surgeons and wanted to get survey information and we chose to pay for it, we would rather not start from scratch and come up with our own survey and maybe people like it, maybe people don't, maybe people think we asked yes, no, and we should have had five options. So if we wanted to do a survey, it would be really nice to have an endorsed nationally standardized survey that we could go to, and it's in the public domain, and we could use it, and it has some face credibility, it has comparison data available, and so that would be a really good reason. Or if a practice, say you've got a group of 20 surgeons, and they wonder how they're doing and what their patients think of them, and they wanted to do it for their own feedback and quality improvement purposes and not ever tell anybody the results, but just use it for their own benefit, again, they would have something with some comparison data, because if you just survey your own patients and your results are 90%, well, is 90% a good rate or a bad rate? Well, if you've got comparison data and the national average is 80 or the national average is 95, that helps you interpret your own 90. So I think that's the reason that the endorsement is helpful, because it could be done in a variety of settings.
This is Bob at ACS, and just to add to that, too, we've had conversations with CMS, and we're trying to promote the use of this with them, and I think the NQF endorsement would be really helpful in that, and they've actually already proposed to incorporate the surgical caps into the OPPS quality reporting program and the Ambulatory Surgery Center quality program as well.
Thank you. Am I the only one on the committee that's concerned about the fact that we're not really seeing the final scale and we don't know the correlation between the mean and the top box scores?
No, I'm a little concerned about that too, Suzanne.
And I certainly like to see what the results are and get a sense and see a distribution. If everybody's got the same score, it's not particularly useful. So that's where having some real data helps.
Would it be possible for the developer to get back to us with that data?
So the document that we were looking at that had the percent yes on it provides some information about variability. So if we go back to that document, you can see that the minimum score here on some of the items is...
Which document are you talking about? You're talking about the submission documents that we have on today's meeting or one of the
Appendix I.
Appendix I.
Okay.
This is the one that has... surgical care survey results from field tests. So it has the items from the field tests, not all of which are in the final, but this is just, these were all of the items that were included in the field test, and then it was narrowed down.
So,
and as we said, the field test tried different numbers of response options for yes, no, and what the final response options are, which are standard on the clinician group CAPS survey are yes, definitely, yes, somewhat, and no. And those final options are on page 17 of the submission. So we have finalized the response options to the three-point frequency. There is one set of questions that is just the yes, no, and that's on surgeons' attentiveness on the day of surgery at the top of page 18. And then the overall rating is a 0 to 10, which is consistent with the other CAP surveys.
Right. This is Karen again. So what you've given us on these results is item by item, but can you at least put together what the score would be based on what you're suggesting goes into a composite? Because you're not suggesting scoring item by item. These are going to be combined into... domains, correct?
So there's a little of both. There's reporting at the item level as well as at the composite level. The difficulty with generating a score at the composite level with the field test data is that some of the wording was slightly modified from the field test to the final. And as I just indicated, some of the items in the field test use different frequency scales, so we would be combining the definitely yes and the somewhat yes on some items with the straight yes, no on other items. So it still really doesn't get you to the final version, which is informed by the psychometrics, by follow-up focus groups on the composites themselves. And so really there isn't a lot of data on the final instrument as we are proposing it because this is a shortened version, and it's not exactly what was field tested. So it would be difficult to and not really informative of the ultimate final version for us to take the field test data and combine the items because they use these different response scales. So really the best information is at the item level, at least to see the variability of response and the general percent at the what is roughly equivalent across the items percent yes.
And is there any work going on right now in terms of further testing of this final, or what you think is final, CAPS and the measures? Has that ended?
Carla and Jill are probably aware of some entities now that are using the instrument, and I don't know if you have the details, Carla or Jill, on that.
This is Carla. I was actually looking at some of the data that came out of the AAO, it's the otolaryngologists, did a feasibility study of it, and they did go ahead and calculate the composites. I believe that they used mean level scoring, and so I'm seeing a range of 66% through high 90s percentages in terms of the mean scoring, and then in terms of the top box results that they found, again, ranging from about 80% through a high 90% at various sites. And that is using the final instrument. But none of these implementations are sponsored by the CAPS Consortium, so we aren't truly owners of the data because the CAPS Consortium doesn't implement the survey. Again, we are the public domain. You know, we put the survey in the public domain.
Right. I'd say as a group, as a committee, if we wind up voting to endorse, that part of our endorsement should include how it should be scored, because if we're trying to endorse something that could be widely used by whomever chooses to use it because it's been validated, it's reliable, and for comparability, then part of that should include how it ultimately is scored and compared. It's not going to be comparable if some people are using top box, some people are using top two boxes, some people are using mean.
Right, and this is Karen, and that's absolutely right. In terms of a performance measure, a national voluntary consensus standard, it has to be something that's going to be used consistently. And what they've submitted for specifications is using the top box, I believe.
And you have a document that's CPT codes where they will only try it out for those CPT codes.
I'm sorry, could you ask that question again?
There's one of the attached documents, the last one. It's CPT codes for surgical CAPS 90-day globals.
Mm-hmm.
Was it only tested on those CPT codes?
Those are the CPT codes that each surgical specialty felt represented the surgeries that they felt should be included.
Because it's kind of an odd array. There's only a couple. I only see a couple of them on here. And actually, it's listed as vascular surgery, but one's an excision of external ear. And there's not that many CPT codes. That's why I thought they were kind of, and it's kind of just a weird array.
Well, if you look at the row numbers, there are actually 17,000 CPT codes.
Okay, so they just showed a small section of them here.
Correct.
Okay.
But the row numbers are the actual row numbers, so there are over 17,000 CPT codes that were identified across numerous specialties.
Okay.
Back to the scoring. I just wanted to clarify that in the field test, different scoring methods and response options were tested, but in the final recommendation on page 17, The final scale is yes, definitely, yes, somewhat, no, with yes, definitely being the top box proportion and the score that would be reported. So we're not recommending mean scoring, essentially. Researchers may want to do mean scoring, but, again, we're recommending top box scoring.
Anybody else from the steering committee with questions? Anybody else from the committee who has questions about this?
Can I admit a little confusion?
Is that Terry?
Yeah. It's fine. I don't want it to slow down the process. It seems like as I've been reviewing some of these documents, they're very lengthy, and there's a lot of stuff there.
Well, this is an incredibly big project. It's very complex, and I think that it was obviously undertaken with a lot of rigor. I think it's a terrific survey, and I think it serves a great purpose. I just am hoping that if we vote to endorse it, that it will be, you know, it won't get, the process won't break down because of confusion about scoring or the meaning of the scores.
Right. So could we be very directive and prescriptive about that? Because I agree with you. It looks like a lot of rigor, in fact, was addressed and spent addressing what should be fundamentally a fairly simple question. Did your medical care work, and were you happy with it? I agree that without having some sort of common answering matrix, that is, if everybody has to speaking the same language, because what's going to happen is our scores say we're the best. Well, if someone else is using another kind of measurement grid, then best against whom? You're setting up for apples and oranges, as I'm sure you all know. So is there some way that we as a committee can say we're inclined to endorse this, but only if you can prescribe a common method of reporting results?
And I'm sorry, this is Joanne. I do want to clarify that prescription is actually already out there and available and extremely documented. But again, these are in the attachments, as maybe you were looking through. So attachment G has instructions for analyzing data from CAPS surveys. And attachment H has the reporting measures for the CAPS surgical care survey. And that provides specific instructions for how to report the overall ratings using the top box scoring method.
Okay, so then why are we talking about variability in reporting?
Because there was confusion around it. It wasn't clear from the documentation that we were looking at that was actually the process, and because the measure developers, as they introduced it, talked about different methods for reporting. It was really unclear. Also, the data that we received was put forward in a variety of ways. It was only yes, only no for some of them. It was the yes, definitely's and yes, somewhat's were combined for some of them. So it's right that you're confused and that, you know, we as a steering committee are paying attention to this issue. Although the measure developers say that they have stipulated it clearly in their attachments, it obviously it needs to be more clear because we're spending a whole lot of time discussing it.
I think one of the things that makes this process unclear is that as the CAPS Consortium, we have not made a firm recommendation in terms of scoring. We've kind of said you have options. There are philosophical reasons. There are many reasons why a survey sponsor might choose to do different types of scoring. And so in testing of the CAPS surveys, we often look at the scores in a variety of ways to make sure that the psychometrics hold up depending on how you look at the data. And so what you're seeing is that variety of all the different ways that we look at the data. The reason that we have recommended top box scoring is because we are seeing a trend in the industry now with clinician and group and the hospital survey that public reporting is moving towards top box scoring. So we are making a definitive recommendation to you, despite the numerous ways that we've looked at the data, that for consistency, both in how people are used to seeing CAHPS data, as well as what we anticipate future sponsors of the survey might require, we are recommending the top box scoring to you.
Okay, and that's what we need because we're not a research group. We're a policy group.
Correct.
So we're talking about policy, which is a little bit different. And I think that this, I think it needs to be extremely clear. Is there anybody else on the steering committee that would like to say anything else about this, measure before we move on to start talking about importance and the rest of the criteria?
I would just say I just scanned through the document to say how to analyze, and it was still confusing. So I agree that it needs to be clarified exactly how people want this data to be analyzed. Otherwise, I think it will, because even if you have that document, they still give you a variety of choices.
So Karen and Alexis and anybody else, and Heidi maybe, would it be appropriate for, if this documentation is, if this measure is endorsed and this documentation is made available, would it be appropriate for us to ask for a change in the documentation so that it is, so it doesn't look as much like opportunities for research as it does like a very clear sort of policy endorsement?
This is Karen, and I think that can be probably clarified some more in the actual measure specifications so that it's very clear what is up for NQF endorsement versus obviously all of the other documentation follows a lot of the format that's been set up by the CAHPS consortium, but we can certainly look at the specifications and make sure that those are clear in terms of what how the measure that's being put forward for endorsement would be computed.
Thank you. Anybody else on the committee with any other comments, questions?
One question I have is, I mean, I think from the discussion, everybody likes the idea of this, but at the same time, I think there's a certain amount of discomfort with the fact that final data using the final methodology and so on, results aren't really available. Is it feasible to endorse this as a time-limited measure or something like that to sort of promote it, to get it going, but at the same time to recognize it's not quite final and there's still a little bit of flux involved?
And we're looking for an answer from the NQF on that.
Yeah, this is Heidi. I mean, unfortunately, this type of measure would not really classify within the criteria for time limited. So I don't think we can do that. We need to just thinking through next steps. We can work with the developer, like Karen said, to make sure that it's more clear. But at the end of the day, if you continue to have concerns that the measure, once we make the information more clear, still does not meet the criteria and is not yet ready for public reporting, then I think you need to consider that and perhaps not recommend it. At this point, it's hard to do much more than that. It all depends on what the concerns are and how quickly the developer could provide that information back to us. But there is no opportunity for time limited, unfortunately.
And I would say, since we have a lot of concerns, should we just be saying that we'd like to revisit this one, not vote on it right now?
So, Heidi, I don't know, you can answer that question, but I just also what is the timing of the patient experience with care project?
Yes, hold on a minute. I have it right here. So we do have one additional opportunity. We were trying to see if this measure was, you did feel it was ready, then we wanted to not wait for the upcoming project on that Karen just mentioned. But there is the opportunity for them to bring it forward, and it is, I believe submission is in July of this next year, 2012. So, again, it does mean that this measure would not be endorsed until closer to the end of 2012. If we did wait, that would be the one downside. But there is an opportunity next year to have this reviewed.
Well, this would be up to Heidi and Alexis, but, I mean, you may want to go ahead and have the committee vote so that you really truly know the full range of the committee's thinking about this before, you know, you would decide to postpone or go one way or the other.
So we, I agree. I think that's a good idea if everyone's willing.
So are we voting on the SurveyMonkey because not everybody's on the call?
Yes.
All votes will happen on via SurveyMonkey.
I'm sorry. Can I? This is Carla. Can I just ask one clarifying question? I know the basis of the concern is that you don't have data from the final survey, but and I'm going to kind of ask this in conjunction with ACS as well. Is would it be possible for us to get permission to obtain data from those that we know have implemented it, implemented the survey? To see if they're willing to share their data. We don't own the data, so we didn't put it in the submission. But that sounds like that might address the concerns, and that could potentially be turned around fairly quickly to you.
And I think that would address a lot of the concerns if that were available.
And the reason that I'm asking also ACS, because I think it's something that we could do together since it's a lot of their members.
Alexis, what's our timeline on voting for this?
The committee needs to submit their votes by next Friday, December 9th.
Do you think that, Carla, do you think you could get us that information?
I actually have a draft manuscript that they've worked on based on the data that they've submitted. So, like I said, I know that it exists and I can look at the data. I just, like I said, I could not share that without their permission.
I understand. Do you think that you would be able to get it to us by, say, Wednesday?
I don't think that would be a problem.
Okay. Well, let's give that a try.
Okay. So this is Heidi. So we can wait, perhaps even it's up to Alexis how she'd like to do this, wait and circulate the SurveyMonkey on everything, as well as the information if they're able to get it to us by Wednesday or Thursday. And then I guess the one question I have for the group is, do you feel that you would like to have another conversation about this measure by conference call, or do you think you can handle the remaining issues once we get this to you by email?
Email's fine for me.
I think that it would be probably just be too cumbersome for our committee to have another conference call about it.
Yes.
When you say by Wednesday or Thursday, we don't mean tomorrow or the day after, right? We're talking about next week. I'm also not sure that if we should receive it by Thursday, I don't know that that's really enough time to review it and then vote by Friday.
Right. I really think that I should be able to get it to you sooner than that. Like I said, I just need to reach out to the AAO to get permission to share the data.
Mm-hmm. I think the other question, though, was about clarifying. I don't know if there needs to be some sort of revamping of the submission, clarifying how the data was going to be analyzed. Right? Wasn't that the other question? Was what exactly are we using for data analysis?
Right, to change the specifications to make it more clear.
Well, we've kept it very simple on page 17 of the submission for this endorsement purpose, but the larger CAPS consortium, again, does have a lot of options and some very complex options for risk adjustment and all of this. But users, again, some users use that, some don't. So what we're recommending for this endorsement is on page 17, which is simply top box proportion. And so I just want to be really clear about that, this purpose. The other supporting documentation we've provided, but it sounds like maybe that's confusing the matter more than helping the matter. But
I think it is. Yeah.
The mission itself on page 17 is pretty
What page
clear
is that on ours? Because our numbers are different.
120.
It's page 120.
This is Karen, and also what may be a little confusing is that in the, I think in the section on scoring algorithms, some places it kind of talks about the percentage for each of the responses. So I think we just need to make sure that it's consistent throughout, but we can go through and talk with the developer about that just to make sure that it's this, you know, one way throughout the document.
I think that would be helpful.
Okay.
So is that our plan? Do we need to do anything further with this discussion, Alexis?
No, we will wait for ACS to submit the additional data, and we will work with them to update the submission form to make things more clear.
Okay. Let's see, then I think the only thing that we have left, if there are no other steering committee comments, is a member and public comment.
And Catherine, can you please open the lines for questions, please?
Absolutely. It looks like everyone is open except for Bob and Jacek. And that's it. Everyone else online, their lines are all open.
Any member of public comments? Okay, Alexis, would you like to move on to next steps?
Sure. So once we receive the information from ACS, I will send that information out along with the updated submission form, and I will send the link to the SurveyMonkey so that the committee can vote on the measures discussed on today's call. Just an FYI, some of the measures, including the AAA ARC measures, the committee will be voting on the four major criteria. During the May 4th and 5th meeting, the committee decided to hold off on voting on the four major criteria until the measure developer had updated the measure. So you will be voting on importance, scientific acceptability, usability, feasibility. You will be voting on those four major criteria. Also for the surgical CAPS measure that we just reviewed. Some of the other measures as far as the SVS measures, those AAA measures, you'll just be voting on whether or not you recommend the measure for endorsement along with the prophylactic measures. And I just wanted to give a brief update on the phase one measures. Those measures were reviewed by CSAC and the measures were approved. They're currently with the board and we should have final ratification by the end of this week. And then those measures will go out for a 30-day appeal process. And I'll send out the press release once those measures have been ratified. And the phase two measures are currently in voting, and voting closes on December 5th. And those measures will go to CSAC on December 12th. And I will send out the final CSAC agenda for anyone who would like to call in and listen to the discussion on the 12th. I'll send out that agenda later in the week once it's been finalized. Are there any questions from the committee about anything that I just went over? Hey, Heidi, do you have any additional comments?
No, other than to, again, thank the committee. This has been a phenomenal amount of work that we know you've done, and it is truly very much appreciated by us, and I want you all to know that again.
All right. I think that's it then.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.